Are vegans actually unhealthy?
Does cannabis ruin your sleep?
And why are so many men taking testosterone supplements? I'm Mitch.
And I'm Greg.
And we're the creators of the popular YouTube channel ASAP Science.
Every week on our podcast Side Note by ASAP Science, we explain the science behind a controversial subject with recent research, up-to-date studies, and ridiculous stories so you are entertained while, bam, simultaneously learning.
We're here to make science make sense.
Download Side Note by ASAP Science wherever you get your podcasts.
It is no secret that there's a housing crisis in Vancouver.
A new warning that the Vancouver housing bubble is about to burst. This city singled out for high evidence of problems in its market.
We have also discussed the opioid epidemic a few times on this show.
According to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, overdose deaths involving prescription opioids have quadrupled since 1999. And today, at least half of all overdose deaths involve a prescription opioid.
Those two things, along with a lack of resources, have combined to create a mental health crisis amongst people living on the precarious edges of society. And those people are now, in general, getting older. And the system around them is, to put it mildly, nowhere close to enough. So what happens? What happens when you're approaching old age with nowhere to live, with a host of health problems, with no support and no income, and you just need things like a place to sleep or an address so they can send you your methadone? Welcome to the spot where a handful of the worst failings of Canada's safety net converge. And it's not a pretty place. I'm Jordan Heath Rawlings, and this is The Big Story. Jesse Winter is an investigative reporter at The Star, Vancouver. He's done a lot of work on the big picture of this problem, but he's also done a ton of work on the small picture. Jesse, tell me about the person at the center of your story. Who is Melanie Keyes?
So Melanie Keyes is a 65-year-old woman that I met back in the fall. She's in recovery from decades of sustained IV drug use. She's been in recovery for about 2.5 years and is on methadone treatment. I met her through her ex-husband, Richard Griffin, who is actually a source of a colleague of mine, Jen St. Denis, who's done a bit of reporting with him in the past. He got in touch with me back in the fall because he was at his wit's end with the struggles that he was having trying to support Melanie. She came into homelessness about 2 years ago after a long relationship that she'd been in fell apart. And the only person that was there to catch her when she ended up homeless was Richard. And so over the past sort of 2 years, he had been acting as her advocate, trying to help her navigate the bureaucracy of the BC housing and sort of shelter system. And when I met the two of them, it was shortly after she'd spent 66 days consecutively in a hospital bed in a municipality outside of Vancouver because there was nowhere for her to go. There were no shelters that could take her. And there was this pattern that Richard saw playing out where she was getting bounced sort of back and forth between various different jurisdictions that seemed, from his perspective, to just not want to deal with the care and the needs that she had.
What does that cycle look like that you describe, the bouncing from place to place? What does it look like, on the ground for someone like Melanie?
It looks like a system that doesn't really care about her. In her case, it would mean hopefully getting admitted to a shelter and spending some time there. In most cases, it seemed that she would spend a couple of weeks, or in some cases, a couple of months, she would sort of exist in a shelter. But in most of these emergency shelters, there are sort of expectations that while you're there, you have to be demonstrating that you're working towards finding permanent housing. And most shelters have staff that will help with that. But at a certain point, if the shelter feels you're not making enough headway towards finding permanent housing, then you're at risk of discharge. And in Melanie's case, there were a few discharges that happened where it's unclear how much support she was getting from the shelters that she was in.
Right.
I mean, at one point they sent her to Surrey Memorial Hospital and they were entirely unclear about why. And so she'll be in a hospital bed for a few days or a few weeks, or in a couple cases, upwards of a month or more. And these are not private rooms. These are hospital beds in open wards. So there's other people around. It's very noisy. It's not a very stable place to be. And then she would just sort of exist there for a while until the hospital decides that we need these, because these are all emergency room beds for the most part.
Right. Yeah. There's other resources that they could be used for.
Absolutely. And so then the hospital is in a really difficult position where they need these beds for other emergency cases. But if they have nowhere to send you, then in some cases, people would just get discharged from the hospital right onto the street and get themselves back into a shelter or whatever. In the case of Melanie, there was one day in particular where she was sent from the shelter to the hospital in an ambulance. The hospital staff evaluated her, said she was fine, put her in a cab back to the shelter. As soon as she got to the shelter, they said, nope, we can't take you. Put her in another cab back to the hospital again, all in one day. So that left her feeling like nobody cares about her, like she doesn't matter.
How is she dealing with all this? And we'll get to the bigger implications of her story in a minute, but I'm fascinated by like just what it would be like to live like that for 2 years.
When I first met Melanie, she was very difficult to interview because she wouldn't speak in complete sentences. She would just sort of yes and no answers. She wouldn't meet your eyes. She was very reluctant to engage with people. She would often sort of defer to Richard during the interviews. It took me a long time to gain her trust, I think. She at first perceived me to be just another cog in the machine and another person who probably doesn't take her story seriously. And she was very beaten down, honestly, is how she seemed. The more I got to know her, the more she started to open up a little bit and would talk about the way this system made her feel, that constantly being shuffled around made her feel like she didn't matter, she wasn't valuable, pretty hopeless in a lot of ways, which was really difficult to see. It did improve later on when she ended up at a different shelter, the Guildford shelter in Surrey, which is run by the Lookout Society. And she did manage to stabilize there. They had a caseworker who really, really sort of leaned in and took Melanie's case on. And I think that really helped. And over the month or so that she was there, she brightened up a whole lot. She started talking about her past. She talked about her, she and Richard have children from years ago. And they were often reminiscing together with me that in a way that she hadn't been doing when she was stuck in the hospital.
When you took this on to look into Melanie's case, it then kind of turned into an investigation. How did that happen?
Mm-hmm. It sort of happened by accident, as some of my investigations tend to do. I was explaining to my editor 6 months or so ago that I have a sort of a strange way of operating, which is that some people, when they do investigations, they'll file access to information requests, they'll dig through records, they start at sort of the 30,000 foot level and look for the problem and then try and find people who exemplify the problem to tell the story. And I tend to go the other way around. So I find people that I connect with sort of down at the bottom end of that, down on the street, basically down at the other end. And then I get to know them and work with them and figure out what is the thing that they're struggling with or that they need help with. And then I start looking more into that. And that's the point at which I realized Richard had come to me and said he was at his wit's end about the impact this was having on him. And the more I got to know him and Melanie, I started to suspect that this was not an isolated case, that this is something that happens very often. And then I started meeting more shelter clients and they started telling me the same sorts of things. I heard from people who were kicked out of shelters for what sounded like really arbitrary reasons. One person, Larry McConkie, who's mentioned in the story, has struggled with alcohol abuse for a long time. And he told me that he got kicked out of a shelter simply for being drunk, even though the shelter claims that it's low barrier, which means that they shouldn't be doing those sorts of things. I heard from shelter clients that said they would be discharged when the shelter said, well, you haven't held up your end of the bargain in terms of looking for housing. But then when I'd say, well, what kinds of things did the shelter do to help you find housing? They'd say, oh, they gave us a list of Craigslist ads and asked us to call people. If you look at the Craigslist ads out here in Vancouver, like most right. of them are places that I can't afford. And I'm also not struggling with a whole bunch of other challenges all at the same time. Like there's a lot of frustration in the system right now.
And so when you started with these people and then went up to 30,000 feet, what kind of issues are in play here that kind of puts these people in this kind of position?
So there are sort of four crises that are all colliding to contribute to this problem. There's the opioid crisis that everyone knows about that has been ravaging Vancouver and BC for years now. There's a housing crisis, an affordable housing crisis. We have an aging population, as there's been a lot of reporting to demonstrate, and a mental health crisis. And so all of these things are coming together and putting downward pressure on the system overall, the housing system, the emergency shelter system, the hospital system. And that downward pressure means that the most vulnerable in the system, people like Melanie, are the ones that get basically shoved out the bottom with nowhere to go. In terms of this issue of people getting bounced around between shelters and hospitals, there's also some other systemic issues at play, one of which is that these systems all tend to operate in silos, and there isn't cohesive communication across the system. This was really evident to me when I was in the hospital room with Melanie at Surrey Memorial, when the staff there wanted to discharge her to a shelter in Chilliwack, which is 70 kilometers away from her friends, her family, her supports. And Melanie is somebody that needs a lot of support. Like, she needs a lot. And in the hospital room, I remember the pharmacist came in and asked Melanie, where should I have your methadone prescription forwarded to? And Melanie said, well, I don't know. You didn't even tell me where you're sending me. And so then the pharmacist turned to the social worker, and the social worker and said, well, which shelter are we going to? And the social worker went, oh, I don't know. Hang on. And then they had to go and like figure that out. They didn't seem to know that Melanie didn't have a bank card or any access to cash. They didn't seem to understand that sending someone with mobility challenges like her to a shelter that has a lot of stairs was a problem. And most of those things could be solved if there was better cohesive communication between the shelter systems and the hospital. And in the immediate term, that's something that really needs to be addressed, like right now.
Is anyone working on it?
Yeah, they are. There's a pilot project that's ongoing in Surrey right now called the Hospital to Shelter Pilot. What that's meant to do is shelters in the Surrey area will set aside a certain number of beds specifically for people who are being discharged out of hospitals. And it's meant to smooth the transition and make sure that people don't get discharged right onto the street. I think there is a bit of a question right now about whether that pilot project is being used properly. There might be a training issue, or a number of service providers mentioned it to me. But then when I said, well, how come it didn't work in Melanie's case, no one had an answer. But something like that, I think it's an attempt to solve the problem. And one of the things that it does is when people get discharged from hospital into shelter, in theory, that is also supposed to then provide an opportunity for healthcare staff from the hospitals to come into the shelter and continue providing the level of care that the people need that the shelter staff are not able to provide. That's one thing that is currently being tried anyway. There's also, I'm not sure how much this has made it into Eastern media yet, but as I said, there's a huge problem with homelessness and housing in the Lower Mainland right now. And one of the responses to that has been modular housing. So sort of tent cities and immediate homelessness right now. And there's been some suggestion that maybe that could be employed in a way to address the challenges that seniors are facing, where if hospital staff had the ability, or care staff in general had the ability to come into modular housing and provide services there as well, that could be something that would work. Yeah, I mean, it's a tough one for sure.
Did you get any idea when you were reporting it of the scale of this problem? Is anybody keeping numbers? You mentioned that it's kind of, there's a lack of communication going on. How do we get a sense of the severity?
I don't know if anyone is tracking the exact numbers of people being discharged from hospital into shelters. I do know that Fraser Health, for example, which is the health authority that oversees the Lower Mainland outside of sort of the Vancouver area, sort of Burnaby East, about 200 people every day, 200 people who are experiencing homelessness end up accessing Fraser Health emergency room services. Now, whether that's to come in and get treated for a wound on their hand and then discharged, or being admitted and having to spend nights in a bed. But that's 200 people a day. That's a huge, huge drain on the emergency room system that needs to be addressed.
Do some of them go there when they're not ill, simply because they know that that's one of the only places they can actually get a bed?
Yes, that definitely happens. I heard that from a number of shelter clients that I spoke to. Also, the day after my story ran, there was a Canadian press story, the mayor in Tofino, BC, which is like this resort community way on the coast of Vancouver Island, said they have the problem there too, where that their community hospital, which is meant to serve a very large geographic area, is being used as an emergency shelter because people don't have anywhere else to go. And that's a huge problem.
And people are getting older. Like, we've talked to people about our aging population before. Our systems can't really, never mind the hospitals being used as shelters, but our services that are designed for seniors are to the breaking point.
Mm-hmm. That's going to be a thing that we have to wrestle with as the aging population continues to age. Like, there's a lot of people that are going to be reaching the same ages that Richard and Melanie are at right now. that demographic is going to continue to grow. And I mean, that's why we're seeing seniors are now one of the fastest growing segments of the homeless population. Even in Metro Vancouver, the number of homeless seniors went from less than 250 in 2008 to more than 750 in 2017. That's an explosion. Like that's a huge number of people who are very vulnerable, who are literally on the street.
What's it like being a senior in a shelter?
It can be really hard. From some of the people I spoke to, I think it depends on which shelter you're in. There are some shelters that are trying now to cater more towards older populations. In downtown Vancouver, the Salvation Army runs a shelter called the Harbor Light, and it caters to older homeless men because they don't want to be up 24 hours a day. A lot of them are not using drugs the same way that the younger segments of the population are. And so they want a place to go where it's a little calmer, a little quieter, where they can just, you know, sit and play cards with their buddies and get a good night's sleep. But one of the interesting things that I saw out in Surrey is that until last summer, there was a big tent city on 135A Street in Surrey. It's called the Surrey Strip. And there were about 200 people, give or take, who were living in tents along that strip. And a lot of those people were struggling to access shelters because the shelters weren't low barrier, which meant that these people are using. And so if sobriety is a requirement to get into a shelter, that whole segment of the population is excluded. So some of the shelters said, okay, we'll adjust our policies and we'll become low barrier. And that population can now access our services. But that brought with it a whole demographic and a whole series of challenges that made it very difficult for some seniors to stay in the shelters because they felt unsafe. They felt there wasn't space for them. It got too chaotic, too loud, and too sort of disruptive. And so a lot of them felt displaced by that. Now, in that case, it's sort of like, well, whose needs are you going to prioritize? The people that are living on the street or the seniors that are already in the shelter? They both need support. Sort of a conundrum.
Did you get a sense as you started connecting the dots on this that there was any level of government that was working on the big picture that you addressed, not so much on some modular housing or some more communication between shelters, but on the sort of cycle that you described earlier in this chat?
Yes, I think there is. I think there's appetite at the government level to tackle this. I mean, they're dealing with a lot of moving parts and they have to negotiate with different municipalities, some of which are resistant to things like modular housing. This government did create an entire ministry to tackle mental health issues, which is something that, as far as I know, no other province has. So that's a fairly big move that hopefully will yield some changes down the road. But it's something that it's become an almost intractable problem in some ways. And it can be hard to know what the solutions are.
What happened to Melanie in the end as we talk? Kind of, has she gotten some resolution? Is she in any kind of permanent housing?
No. Melanie, at the moment, is still living in the Guildford shelter in Surrey. Her caseworker, Debbie Byron, has started the process to try and get her into government-subsidized assisted living. But the wait list for that is like 5 years long. Melanie's 64. Like you put those two things together and you start to wonder if she's ever going to get into that kind of housing. The Guildford shelter has been a place that's helped stabilize Melanie. I think she said she started to make friends there. She's feeling a little more cared for now, which has really taken a weight off of Richard's shoulders because he was doing most of that casework on his own for so long. But at the same time, Richard, who's been in transitional housing for the last 4 years, is now being told that he has to move out to make space for other people. So he could be looking at a return to homelessness himself. And so both of them are just kind of left wondering what the future is going to bring.
Who else besides you is out there trying to find the other Melanies that are kind of slipping through the cracks in this cycle?
There's a lot of outreach workers and social workers. There are people that are really, really doing this work and taking it on. I think my small contribution was being able to elevate one of those stories to the point at which hopefully people can sort of understand a little bit more. But there are tons of caseworkers, outreach workers who drive outreach vans through the night at way out into the Fraser Valley, which is something that a number of agencies told me they're really seeing, is that they're seeing a lot of homeless seniors being displaced from the downtown Vancouver area out into the valley, into ravines, under bridges, things like that. So those people they're out there and they're trying to reach these people and get them referred to different services. But it's a lot. It's an awful lot for people to take on.
Thanks, Jesse.
Thank you.
Jesse Winter, investigative reporter, The Star Vancouver. That was The Big Story. For more from us, maybe some happier episodes, often not. You can find us at thebigstorypodcast.ca. All of our stuff is there, and all of our other shows are at frequencypodcastnetwork.com. You can find us on social media at TheBigStoryFPN or at FrequencyPods on Twitter, on Facebook, on Instagram. And we are on every podcast platform imaginable, including the old World Wide Web or Apple, Google, Stitcher, or Spotify. Leave us a rating, leave us a review. Thanks for listening. I'm Jordan Heath Rawlings. We'll talk tomorrow.